Let me tell you a little bit about him. He's a professor of physics at MIT. He's been chairman of the MIT Physics Department, which is, I would say, a kind of toughening experience is the way I might describe it. He was director of the Bates Linear Accelerator Center. He joined MIT in 1973. He was educated very well, I might add, at Boston College. He received his bachelor in physics, and at Stanford, where he earned his PhD in theoretical physics. Ernie Moniz is renowned for his work in theoretical nuclear physics, particularly helping us understand the workings of the nucleus and the interaction of the mesons with nuclei, and I'm sure we'd be happy to entertain your questions in that area as well, even though it's not the principal topic, Ernie, of our presentation today. I first met Ernie in 1993, I think, when I was at NSF, and Ernie was a consultant at the White House working on the Science of the National Interest, a statement of the Clinton administration's science policy. He was then recruited actively by the administration to come to the White House, and he served as Associate Director of Science from 1995 to 1997. And then in 97, President Clinton tapped him to be the Undersecretary of Energy, Science, and the Environment at DOE, a portfolio that is as challenging as any I know in the federal government. I mean, in some sense, from my perspective, DOE is more complicated than the entire federal government, but that's a question for later. Ernie served in that capacity till the end of the administration and was enormously effective, in my view. He continues to be very active in energy matters. He serves on many boards and advisory committees. He's a member of the Council of Foreign Relations, advises government on policy, including energy matters that he'll talk about today. He is co-director of MIT's Laboratory for Energy and the Environment and was co-director of the Energy Research Council, or is, I guess, it's an existing activity, issued a very important report, more than one, I think, but one I'm familiar with on nuclear energy. He's been honored often and in many ways, which I won't try to list. I'll tell you one Ernie story. He was testifying before a committee of Congress, a very important committee, and the chair was a very powerful member of Congress. And as I understand the story, When Ernie was being introduced by the chairman of the committee said, "I like Dr. Moniz. He knows stuff." Well, let me tell you, he does know stuff. And we're going to hear some of that stuff right now. So please welcome Ernie Moniz.
Thank you, Neil. You were spared other stories because Neil knew I had plenty of ammunition to retaliate with and would have done so. But today, as Neil said, our subject is energy and security. To start, I think we should really frame kind of the path ahead in energy with this so-called perfect storm of energy challenges. We have projected certainly enormous increase in supply requirements over this say half century, a doubling or more of primary energy, perhaps a tripling of electricity use. We have, of course, energy and security challenges, which will be exacerbated by a large increase, particularly in our use of certain hydrocarbons. And, of course, we'll come back and discuss that in more detail. And then a theme also that you've heard a lot of, if you've been attending some of the other sessions on energy and environment, climate change in particular, energy and environment, but climate change in some ways is an issue that goes to the very heart of the energy infrastructure, which, as we shall discuss in more detail, is in fact 85% fossil fuel dependent. Now, a point I will stress is that these last two elements, energy and security, and energy and climate change in particular, are very, very tightly linked, and much of our discussion will be, in fact, how we can simultaneously, if you like, address those two challenges. Now, if we look at energy security issues, the first thing I want to stress is that there are actually a multiplicity of issues involving energy and security. The supply of oil and gas from mainly in the U.S., but the oil in particular, being largely now imported, more than half, and with the sources being in politically challenging regions, has obviously been the focus of much of our discussion of energy and security. But it is worth pointing out, although I will not go into all of these in detail, that there are other issues. First of all, more and more energy supply delivery is over extended distances, and the vulnerability of that energy supply chain is, of course, a major security issue. That's not only due to, say, terrorist concerns, but also to natural events like hurricanes. Indeed, Hurricane Katrina was the biggest supply disruption that we've had in some time in this country. A third issue, which is very particular to nuclear power, is that the spread of nuclear power globally, which we may be on the threshold of seeing a major expansion, does raise issues about the possibility of misuse of fuel cycle development for weapons proliferation. Of course, Iran today is in the news very much precisely because of this issue. And finally, to stress that environmental impacts themselves, particularly, again, those that may be brought upon us by climate change, are also a security issue. For example, while very, very frankly unclear in the science, certainly the science that has been done would suggest that significant warming would have major impacts on water resources in, let's say, the Eastern Mediterranean, Mideast, not exactly a place that needs one more complication in its political and economic development. So these are four issues. In fact, I should, again, so on the climate change case, there would be sort of two threads going back to the more general security issue with fossil fuels. One is this issue of the security issues that could come from the impacts of climate change, but the other is on the solution side, how various technology and policy pathways could address both our security and our environmental concerns simultaneously. Now, with regard to oil, clearly our large and growing dependence on imported energy, oil, and increasingly natural gas, obviously can constrain our foreign policy objectives and activities and increases our risk to both supply and price disruptions. There are several implications of this, of course. U.S. energy policy needs to treat more effectively, frankly, or integrate more effectively energy considerations into our security and foreign and environmental policy considerations, an integration for which I'll come back to this perhaps, for which we are not, frankly, very well organized in the government. It's important to stress that while we have somewhat limited levers for addressing some of these international issues with regard to oil supply, it's very different when we come to the demand side. And, of course, demand reduction is another way of addressing this question of imported energy. And so that's something, of course, that we can address domestically. And again, I will come back and discuss that. Certainly attractive jingles like energy independence are, frankly, more part of the problem than they are part of the solution. Because international strategies, again, with frankly limited opportunity, can include things like more transparency in the operation of international oil markets, reducing infrastructure vulnerability in an international collaborative way, trying to have hydrocarbon revenues in certain countries used more effectively. But clearly, our leverage for accomplishing these kinds of objectives is, in fact, somewhat limited, again, in contrast to our potential domestic actions in terms of reducing demand, shifting from fossil fuels, and perhaps organizing in a way to better address energy policy. But today, I am not going to go further with a discussion of, say, Middle East politics, et cetera, but rather, as I say, I will turn now to some of the pathways forward after framing the issue in somewhat more detail. But given time constraints, let me start by, in some sense, summarizing some of the key messages, and then we'll come back and try to defend some of these or put more context behind them as we can. The first, and I must say, Bill Clinton was, of course, a wonderful warm-up act yesterday with this first message, that addressing security and climate change challenges to the United States and global energy supply and demand together, the emphasis on together, offers many synergistic opportunities, and as President Clinton said yesterday, is likely a very powerful way to address the policy challenges we have with climate change. Furthermore, prudence will suggest that we really have to start now aggressively if we are to address these twinned challenges. A next key message will be that as we approach solutions, scale really matters. We will have to talk about the scale of the energy endeavor and the scale of some of the solutions. There is, of course, scale on one side, an enormously capitalized energy infrastructure with a large inertia, but there are also scale issues in terms of some of the solutions in renewables and other technologies at what I will call the terawatt scale, to be explained in a few minutes, or explained already if you went to the tutorial earlier this afternoon. Continuing on with some of the key messages, again, as one thinks about solutions, particularly technology-oriented solutions, I think it's important to understand that energy technology innovation and introduction at large scale is very price-sensitive. And a reason for that is when you think about what new energy technologies do, they really do not provide you a new functionality. They provide you new ways of addressing current functions. For example, a biofuel moves your car. It's not a new function, in contrast to, let's say, when cell phones were introduced. And this is a very important issue in terms of how technologies can come into play. One of the implications of that, in fact, is a limitation on the government's options for really promoting energy technology innovation and especially deployment. The government can certainly fund, let's say, basic research relevant to energy technology, but when it comes to deployment, it's awkward for the government because not having a new function means that you are running into incumbent energy suppliers, and that, of course, just invites political chaos, basically. There are, of course, many ready technologies, many promising ones, more to come, that need to be aligned with policy, because policy is very important for setting the parameters of price sensitivity. And I want to stress I'm using the word price and not cost. So, for example, the most obvious approach would be to price the so-called externalities like carbon emissions, environment, security concerns, and to do so in a timely way. And we'll come back to discuss more quantitatively what that means. But, of course, price externalities is a rather euphemistic way of saying put a price on, whether it's a tax or a cap-and-trade system, let's say, on carbon emissions, for which there has so far been, certainly in this country, a noticeable political unwillingness to deal with it. And so instead, one deals with the usual cocktail of rather inefficient mechanisms, often subsidies, technology choices, portfolio standards. And this is the kind of choice that we are going to have to face if we wish to address the security and environmental problems in a timely fashion. Again, to be elaborated on. Fourth message, international engagement is frankly unavoidable for any real solution to these problems. And that's true on both the environment and the security side. Climate change is an obvious case where international collaboration is essential, but also things like expanding the oil reserve system to include the new major user economies like China is essential. Working internationally to keep markets functioning is an important security activity, et cetera. And finally, the last message is that we are using the terms energy policy often, but should recognize that whether or not such two words should be joined together is questionable in the sense that energy policy is often really a concoction of security policy, foreign policy, environmental policy, fiscal policy, tax policy, land use policy, et cetera, and needless to say, when you have all of these factors coming together, it is very difficult for the government to be, shall we say, organized to promote a coherent energy policy. So that's, again, kind of a set of messages. And what I'd like to do now is to go into providing more of a framework and then make some specific comments with regard to scale and technology pathways. So the first thing is we should talk a little bit about where we are today with the energy supply chain. And there are various key factors. It's a multi-trillion dollar a year business, which suggests inertia. It's dominated by fossil fuels, about 85%, with most conventional oil and natural gas reserves in politically challenging regions. It's global in reach, and it's essential for nearly every societal activity. So let's elaborate a little bit on each of these points. Now, I apologize for the numbers. It's been said that man would rather commit suicide than do arithmetic. But nevertheless, we cannot avoid making the scale point without some numbers. So we will do arithmetic. I'm hoping that you will not tarnish the Aspen Institute's reputation with a mass suicide. So just kind of, you know, hang in there for those of you who don't like dealing with all these numbers. Really, all I want to do here is focus on a couple of points. First of all, the total world primary energy use in 2002 was about 435 exajoules. I'll come back and explain that. But first, just look at the contributions to that 435. The point to notice is oil, 170, is clearly the top dog by a lot, with the other fossil fuels coming in at about 100, at about 100 each. Now, if you multiply that number of energy units by, let's say, something approximating current prices for fossil fuels, just the fuel costs alone are over $2 trillion. And if you multiply by some factor to account for conversion delivery, as you can see, we are talking about a multi-trillion dollar a year industry, very, very large in scale. Now, let me say a few words about the units. Again, I apologize for this kind of didactic piece, but I think we need it. First of all, an exajoule means 18 zeros joules. Now, what's a joule? To try to give at least some kind of human scale, if a family of four, which means 200 kilograms, rides up the Empire State Building, that's about 600,000 joules, 1/700 trillionth of the globe's energy use. It's also interesting to note what is at these prices. What is the cost of a fossil fuel for 600,000 joules, enough to lift you 1,000 feet in the air with your family? 0.6 cents for oil and 0.1 cent for coal. In other words, we should always remember these are very, very cheap for the amount of work we get out of it. So that's the energy unit. One last unit, and then we'll go back to the main text, is power. Just to stress that power is energy per given time. So the more the faster you, let's say, use an amount of energy, the higher is the power. And a watt, a unit that you're familiar with, 60-watt light bulbs, et cetera, is one of those units, joules per second. We used 435 exajoules in 1 year. That is a power of 13.8 trillion watts, terawatts. That's the rate at which we use power, or we use energy globally. Get on a human scale, your travel hairdryer in the hotel room is something like 1,400 watts. 10 billion of those hairdryers on at one time would be the rate at which we use energy, given only 6 billion people in the world. Of course, that's quite a trick. But once again, the cost is, again, kind of remarkable. Electricity at 10 cents a kilowatt hour, using that hairdryer for 3 minutes, again, 0.6 cents, okay? So, again, those are the units. Hope to give you some idea of scale, but also the message that the way that the energy infrastructure that we have, largely fossil fuel-based, really provides a lot of energy, a lot of power, with a remarkably at a remarkably small cost. Now, how did we get here? This is a slide I borrowed from Steve Coonan from BP, who spoke yesterday. This shows the fuel mix in the United States from 1850 until today. And Steve notes that the actual amount of energy in wood, for example, was the same in 1850 as it is in 2000. So this is percentages, but the amount of energy, of course, has grown enormously. And what you can see here is how coal and then oil and then natural gas in particular come in with a characteristic timescale of about 50 years. In other words, 50 years is, for a variety of reasons, the kind of time period over which the energy infrastructure can undergo significant change. And we will use that 50-year timescale for our discussion for a variety of reasons. This is one, but also 50 years is about the time in which we will double, we will reach doubling of CO2 levels compared to pre-industrial times if we don't change our pathway. So this is a reasonable time for us to try to look for solutions to our security and our environmental problems. You also see here that how coal, gas, and oil, the hydrocarbons, fossil fuels, generate about 85% of U.S. and, frankly, also of global energy supply. Up at the top, you see these little incursions of nuclear and non-hydro renewables. And, of course, one of the major questions going forward will be the extent to which those non-carbon-emitting energy sources can displace fossil fuels. Now, This is just to reinforce the idea that the distribution of fossil fuels is by some accounts unfair and drives some of these security issues. As you can see in the Middle East, there is an enormous fraction of the world's oil and gas resources, which are the two left-hand bars. The blue are coal. Coal is much more evenly distributed in the sense the United States in particular has enormous coal reserves, whereas, again, the Middle East, and if you throw in Russia, has by far the dominant oil and gas reserves. So finally, looking forward, here is one projection. This is using an MIT economic model, but don't take the details too much. But this shows a so-called business-as-usual scenario going forward. This means technology advances at kind of its historic rate, and there are no major new policies, in particular, for example, let's say no stringent carbon control policies. And what you see is, surprisingly, business as usual gives you business as usual. Fossil fuels remain about 85% of energy supply out to mid-century, with clearly other things coming in somewhat, including, for example, in this case, biofuels, which is the upper blue wedge. But, of course, the issue was going to be, in some sense, to what extent, I mean, this picture is, roughly speaking, a disaster for climate change and a disaster for security, with the oil and gas increases. So the question is going to be, how can we address this? Well, first of all, the good news in a certain sense is that any of these scenarios are very uncertain on this time scale. There are multiple uncertainties. Uncertainty in demand, uncertainty in resource availability, uncertainty in technology breakthroughs, uncertainty in geopolitical considerations. We certainly need a portfolio of technology and policy options. Let me discuss a little bit about these uncertainties. This shows today energy use per person on the left axis, on the vertical axis, against GDP per person on a purchasing power parity basis. Way up there in the corner, if you can read it, mark number 3, that's the United States. Very large GDP and very large energy use per person. Down here, I can't point here. The cluster that you see on the lower line at around $25,000 per person GDP is Western Europe and Japan. As you can see, a significant difference in how energy relates to GDP in those countries compared to the United States. But then, of course, you see this whole bunch of countries clustered down at the lower left-hand corner, rather low GDPs and rather low energy use per person. So the question is going to be, as those countries, as those emerging economies increase their economic activity, increase their energy use, the trajectory they follow is very, very critical. When China triples its GDP in 15 years, for example, the difference of being on the upper trajectory or the lower one is about 50 exajoules, if you remember our earlier statement. So well more than 10% of global energy use is the difference in that trajectory. Some of it will be technology. Some of it will be behavior. In fact, having, of course, used a BP slide I need a Chevron slide, which you have in your packets. This is one example, I think, that kind of points out how choices, the caption, if you can't read it, says, "I suppose I could live with two slices at a time," which is kind of a nice look at the kinds of choices that we and others in the world will be making in the years ahead. Now, so that's demand. A second issue, as I said, is a supply of oil. This is one particular slide that shows the kind of standard projections of oil use going forward, rising. And the one that turns over is from the Association for the Study of Peak Oil. Now, I will say right up front, I do not personally believe that our conventional oil resources are going to peak in anything like this with this kind of scenario, but it does reflect the uncertainties in our ability to produce and deliver so-called conventional oil over the years ahead. However, one should also remember that today the price of oil, $70-$75 a barrel, is not a true reflection of the cost of producing oil today. So we have quite a bit of headroom for bringing new resources to bear within the kind of cost envelope that is being discussed today. Next, going back to climate change, there are various ways of addressing climate change, and in particular, I will just mention two quickly, well, three. Efficiency and conservation are absolutely critical. The less energy you use, the less you have to emit. Then there's a set of carbon-less technologies, renewables and nuclear. And finally, there is the option of capturing carbon dioxide and then sequestering it, burying it essentially in geological formations. These are all possible pathways. And I will just point out that when you look at where CO2 is emitted in the United States, the two major numbers are electricity, where the emissions are mainly coal, and transportation, where the emissions come from oil. So those are the places that we will be looking principally to address the carbon issue. And, of course, in addressing the oil issue, one is at the same time certainly addressing the security concerns. And to a certain extent, natural gas and electricity can raise security concerns. So finally, in this framing, we talked earlier about the need for pricing externalities. In this case, carbon emissions. What is it worth, in a certain sense? What price should we add to emitting, let's say, a ton of carbon dioxide? What I'm going to show now is a scenario, again from this MIT economic model, that shows the response of the global energy economic system to certain prices of CO2 emissions. The lower line, the orange line, is the trajectory. It's actually the off-ramp of the National Commission on Energy Policy. It starts at $7 a ton in 2010 and goes up to about $50 at mid-century. The higher trajectory starts at $25 in 2015 and goes to about $100. Now, what does this mean in terms of scale? Roughly speaking, $1 of CO2 emission price corresponds to 1 cent per gallon of gasoline and to about a tenth of a cent per kilowatt hour for a coal plant. So $100, for example, sounds enormous, but that's $1 a gallon of gasoline and 10 cents per kilowatt hour of electricity. You can draw your own judgments as to whether that is exorbitant or not, but that's what it means. So we're going to look now at the response of the system to this kind of a price. Here, what's shown here are global carbon emissions under the three scenarios: business as usual, low tax, high tax. Let's focus on the high tax, the lower line. Basically, that trajectory, if we could have a policy that led to that kind of trajectory, we would have a decent shot of staying below twice pre-industrial concentrations of CO2. And then we can discuss later on the implications of that. That is not a comfortable place to be, but maybe the best we can aspire to. But what does it mean in terms of fuel mix? I want to spend a little time on this. So if you remember the last scenario I showed you with business as usual, first of all, there is a significant reduction in overall energy use. So there's more efficiency going on. But you notice now oil is kind of flat. I do want to stress, it is in no sense going to zero, but it's basically flat. Gas is going up by about a factor of 2. Coal is going up by about 60%, but 2/3 of it is being captured and sequestered. And then there's some nuclear and some renewables, but the dark blue, is biofuels. Obviously a very, very major growth. Now, this scenario, if realized, would be wonderful for both security and environment. You saw the CO2 trajectory with this. Let me talk a little bit more about security implications. With regard to oil, you notice again, oil is not going down. Maybe it's gone up to about 100 million barrels per day. But this picture has about 45 million barrels per day of biofuel at mid-century. The security equation does not come from stopping oil use. It comes from having elasticity in the fuels market. So when you have this kind of interplay between petroleum-based fuels and biofuels, you would, in fact, greatly ameliorate security concerns. Now, having said that, one should not have the impression this is easily achieved. Oh, I'm sorry. This is the emissions from coal in that picture. And in the blue line, what you see is that sharp drop is because you've begun this process of carbon capture and sequestration. Oops, one more I forgot. And this shows that the impact on GDP is not large. This does not mean there are not internal winners and losers, but it's not large. However, there is an assumption that the revenues from carbon pricing are recycled essentially with perfect efficiency into the economy. So what are the challenges to realization of this scenario, which, as I said, is very attractive from both security and reasonably attractive from security and climate change points of view? Well, first of all, there's 45 million barrels a day of biofuels. Now, if you went to yesterday's discussion with Jim Woolsey and Steve Coonan and heard Vinod Khosla, you would say, this does not violate any law of physics. At the upper end of today's conversion of sunlight into fuels from plants, this would require about 10% of the world's arable land. Now, hopefully you have some breakthroughs that drop that down, but 10% is not impossible, just difficult. And tremendous system issues to be discussed in terms of the use of land, soil quality, et cetera, et cetera. But nevertheless, possible. Secondly, as I said, we had 2/3 of that coal emissions being captured and sequestered. That's about 7.7 billion tons of CO2 per year in 2050. But to translate that into our units of like oil use today, 85 million barrels, this corresponds to 100 million barrels per day of supercritical carbon dioxide being injected into geological formations. Once again, not impossible, but certainly very challenging on many grounds. I should say, however, that in that scenario that I showed, nuclear power expansion was externally limited, and things like wind and solar photovoltaics were growing only at, you know, many, many percent per year. Now, one could have breakthroughs, and so things like those renewables, nuclear, in some sense would compete directly with this need for coal and sequestration. So there's a lot of technology play that will go on in there, but this is a very, very large scale. Then there are some if you like, political challenges. One would be that for that scenario to be realized, you would need global participation, i.e. China, India, Brazil, not to mention the United States, a little delicacy that we don't like to bring up too often, but it would require global participation of all the major economies in that kind of a stringent carbon control regime, roughly speaking by 2020. The OECD countries earlier, maybe China, et cetera, 2020, a few years later. A non-trivial political diplomatic challenge. And finally, as I mentioned, to have this scenario not croak economies does require efficient reinvestment of the CO2 revenues. I won't speak for other countries, but given the U.S. Congress's activities, this may be the biggest challenge of all, the efficient recycling of these revenues. None of these are impossible. They're all major challenges. They all have to happen for this kind of scenario to play out. In fact, I'll go back and mention one other thing with this scenario here. We mentioned earlier in the context of innovation in the in energy technology how the idea of going up against incumbency is a major challenge for the federal government in pushing deployment of novel energy technologies. Let's look at this picture and talk about incumbents. For example, the major oil companies are clearly incumbents with a lot of resources. This picture is not bad for oil companies. And not because the oil use is not going down, but for a much more profound reason. You've heard here, in fact, yesterday Steve Coonan gave a talk. This was a representative of a major oil company. And what was this talk about? It's about biofuels. Because the major oil companies are positioning themselves clearly as energy companies as opposed to oil companies. So there's nothing wrong with this picture where you have oil at 100 million barrels a day, gas at twice today's use, 45 million barrels a day of biofuels, and by the way, management of 100 million barrels of supercritical CO2 for injection into the ground. Who knows how to do that? Oil companies. But on the other side, as you've heard in other talks, we may have things like, let's say, plug-in hybrids on a large scale, in which case electricity becomes a fuel. Well, that's an opportunity for utilities to grow. So this competitive environment for a new mix of energy infrastructure actually could be quite positive for introducing carbon control regimes, could be quite positive for pushing new technologies in ways that governments do not do. So this is a very important point that this kind of picture certainly opens up the playing field, and there will be winners and losers, but it's not obvious who they will be, which is very important for moving forward. I'll skip that. Okay, I'll make one more point on this, and then I think it's probably time to go to questions. The other challenge that we had there, the last challenge on the, let's say, the government's ability to recycle CO2 revenues efficiently, I have nothing to say about. But let's talk a little bit about the third challenge, which was the one of global participation. Now, we are often told, and I think we are told it because it's probably true, that in the end, the major obstacle in the United States for moving forward on this climate security agenda is the free rider problem perceived with regard to China especially, but other emerging economies. That is the fact that they would not, so-called, play in a control regime. So again, using this scenario as kind of a tool for seeing how the system responds, rather than this is the blue line is again the high tax we showed earlier. The green line is taking that tax and shifting it 10 years later for the non-OECD countries. In other words, it says they play, but they play at a later time after their economies have done more growing. This is the slide you saw before in terms of carbon emissions, except for the purple lines. That's what happens when you delay by 10 years. The message is, clearly, it increases carbon dioxide emissions, but not in a killer way. Roughly speaking, it soaks up, the time delay soaks up about 6% of the budget of CO2 emissions to hold within doubling. So in other words, this suggests an obvious pathway in terms of CO2 control in which the OECD countries lead, but not lead by an enormous amount, maybe a 10 or 15 year lag, the large emerging economies. Okay, I think I'm going to end by not going to the discussion of this, but just at least enumerating the oil and energy security responses. The core issue, which we referred to in that scenario of with biofuels and petroleum, the core issue is that today our transportation fuels market is very inelastic. It's essentially all based upon petroleum, and with its obvious geographical and geophysical realities. In other words, it's mostly in the Middle East. So there are three kinds of approaches to addressing this problem. First, we want to address sudden disruptions. This is fundamentally a policy issue, international policy issue. We have built up in the OECD countries over 1 billion barrels of reserves. As I said earlier, we now need to bring in China, India, other countries into this reserve system. And we need to advance well-functioning markets. Why are markets a security tool? The reason is well-functioning markets lead to a prompt reallocation of resources to where they are needed, something that we saw, in fact, after the Katrina hurricane. The second issue is to increase and diversify supplies of petroleum, especially in diverse geographies. We should note there are many opportunities. Current recovery rates in oil fields, 35-40%. Plenty of room to go with new technology, with new science, new technology. And mature fields are not all located in the Middle East. The Arctic remains a largely unexplored and produced area, North Slope being an exception. And finally, there are all the unconventional reserves of oil, which are enormous, 300 billion barrels, for example, heavy oil in Canada alone, comparable to Saudi Arabia's conventional oil reserves, but of course very difficult to produce without major environmental damage, without CO2 emissions. So many challenges, but again, a lot of supply. In other words, there's a lot of hydrocarbon molecules left in the ground. They may not be the molecules you like, but we can deal with it if we have to at a certain price. And finally, major pathway, of course, is weakening the president's term addiction to oil with very efficient vehicles, alternative fuels like biofuels or coal and gas, or new transportation paradigms, those based upon, for example, electricity or hydrogen as fuel. Again, we won't have time. Well, one more Chevron cartoon, the Oil Addiction Treatment Center, again, going to the behavioral side of the issue. But I think I just want to end by saying that, again, I apologize for some numbers here, but as we've already discussed in biofuels, and Steve Coonan discussed yesterday, biofuels, one of the very interesting pathways, for example, to in fact have replacements, have a more elastic market. But we should remember that our addiction didn't come frivolously. If you just look at this third column, again, the units, megajoules per liter, amount of energy in a particular volume, and compare those top ones, oil, gasoline, diesel, 35 or so, let's say, of those units, compared to, at the bottom, liquid hydrogen. Liquid hydrogen, we all have the impression, is this super fuel. Hard to deal with, but super fuel because it sends space shuttles up. Well, it has a much lower energy density per unit volume than petroleum-based fuels. Petroleum-based fuels are also dispensed easily. In fact, when you are filling your gasoline tank at 15 gallons, let's say in 3 minutes, you are delivering energy at 10 megawatts. This is hard competition. The addiction is something that's real. I will note that liquid hydrogen has more energy per mass. That's why it's good for the space shuttle. If you want to travel vertically, I suggest liquid hydrogen. But if you want to travel horizontally, I suggest gasoline or some of the replacements that we are developing. So with that, I will stop. Again, there are a bunch of messages here. There is, I would say, by demonstration, a way for us to go forward, address our security and our climate concerns together. But it's not going to be easy. It's going to require really this. We have to succeed in some of these technology areas, like biofuels, like carbon sequestration, like renewables, like nuclear. And we have to succeed simultaneously politically to have the will to take more than baby steps, for example, on the carbon problem, but get into a serious regime that will begin to shift this mix and to do it in a way that we are efficient in using those revenues. Thank you.
Well, we've got questions, I know, but I want to ask one question to start out with, and just one. And that's sort of in the realm of political challenges. I wonder, Ernie, if you could briefly compare or contrast how previous administrations and the current administration have addressed what you consider to be the most important policy issues in a portfolio that I know is very complicated, having to do with the issue of the oil and climate change set of problems.
Well,
and you can go back to George Washington if you want, but wherever you want to start.
Okay. Well, first of all, on oil, one should remember that we have taken a number of steps since the first oil embargoes of the 70s. For example, this petroleum reserve system that I mentioned has grown, and I think it's pretty well coordinated among the OECD countries. There is certainly, we need to revisit the policies because the market has changed, but that's an example which has been, I would say, across many administrations in terms of that approach to oil. With regard to, let's say, weakening the addiction in terms of the vehicles, I think the current administration's focus on hydrogen has been unfortunate. I want to make it very clear. I'm in no sense saying that we should not be developing or looking at the science, the technologies, fuel cells, et cetera, hydrogen storage for hydrogen, but we should also recognize that it has got enormous challenges to be a practical transportation approach. And secondly, it's very far off. And the problem is it has imbalanced the portfolio from looking at other approaches to more efficient vehicles. In the Clinton administration, an often maligned, but I would argue successful, partnership for new generation vehicles, in fact, provided forerunner approaches to lots of what you'd call the hybrid technologies today. But I should stress that when it comes to the weakening of the addiction part, there are enormous number of tricks, if you like, up our sleeves that are not being played. I mean, hybrids are a clear and very interesting technology, plug-in hybrids. But let me go back a step. Much more modest approaches, which have not yet been incorporated, for example, and it could be combined with hybrids, but for example, we talk about how biofuels are being deployed today, including with this rather, in my view, unfortunate E85 focus, as opposed to using smaller amounts of biofuel to get you more broader impact. And I'll just mention that, see, biofuels, in addiction to weakening the addiction, to displacing oil, they have a property, ethanol, let's say, of having very high octane. You don't need high octane all the time. You need it at high torque. You can find ways of using even small amounts of ethanol to get much more efficient compact engines with much higher efficiency. There's a lot of things we could do, but we have not had the policy guidance to push us this way. On climate change, which is clearly connected, obviously the current administration has focused on the, quote, technology is the answer. Technology is always the answer. The issue is, what's the policy to condition the marketplace for the right technologies? And certainly I am convinced that this cannot happen without a relatively near-term substantial pricing of CO2 emissions, which, as I said earlier, does not have to cook the economy. Now, that will not happen in this administration by announcement. I will venture a guess. I believe it will happen in the next administration, independent of party. And the reason is that industry is a lot of industry now wants it. GE wants it. As I said earlier, with this picture up there, that's a great business model for oil companies. Utilities are moving into new technologies. Many of them are asking for it. Duke, big utilities are asking for it. So I believe that the conditions have changed dramatically in the last 10 years, and industry, I think, will lead the next administration towards a carbon control regime.
Thank you. Let's start in the back.
Not wanting to be pessimistic, but to be realistic and candidly speaking, the scenarios that you outlined, all of them individually seem pretty improbable, certainly difficult, but all of them together in combination, achieving all of them seems really highly unlikely. Therefore, in order to deal with this situation, looking back in history, it seems that some kind of shock is required, unfortunately, to reorganize a society to deal with this. One is my question, do you agree with that? And two, do you think the pricing of CO2, let's say it does happen in the next administration, do you think that's sufficient enough to start the trend and give us enough time to deal with this, or is there so much inertia in the problem that it may be very, very difficult to abate it?
Well, first of all, you're certainly right that any probability less than one multiplied four times can be a small number. And as I said, none of those four are easy challenges. None of them are impossible. Frankly, I probably in the end have more confidence in the two technology challenges than in the two political challenges, but we'll have to leave it there. Now, in terms of the shock, I think that the issue of fossil fuel prices is a dangerous hat to nail to hang one's hat on. On the other hand, it's unlikely that we're going to collapse back to prices that we had seven years ago, and that will keep some focus on the problem. But probably, and this is where there's certain disagreement, but probably the pathway that I would think possible for going this way is that we will continue to see more and more pressure building up on the carbon dioxide side, climate change. There's lots of reasons out there right now to be prudent. In fact, of course, I think is one thing I think we have failed to communicate is that the uncertainties in climate change and its impacts are not a reason for inaction, but a reason for action. Particularly now when you, as President Clinton said yesterday, align your policy implementation instruments with the security concerns. So I think that's kind of the way that one kind of tries to thread through this, that the climate, the prudent climate response is also giving you other synergistic benefits.
I'm sorry, I should have asked. Would you state your name, because we're recording?
Brian Zwan.
Thank you very much. Next question, please. Up here, and then I'll go back.
My name is Raymond Learzy, and I have two questions. First, you mentioned a number of various sources of hydrocarbons. We're standing almost on probably the largest known reserves of hydrocarbons in the world, which are the Rocky Mountain oil shale deposits. I was wondering if you could comment a little bit on that. I understand their reserves here are approaching 2 trillion barrels of oil. Secondly, you also mentioned about the transparency of markets. Could you explain how we've reached a price of $75 a barrel? After Katrina, it was $73 a barrel. Today, we're at about $75 a barrel for crude oil, whereas for natural gas, after Katrina, we were at $15 an MCF, and now we're under $6 an MCF. It seems that there are certain market forces at play with regard to natural gas that don't seem to impact or are neutralized by the trading in the oil market. And it's a mystery, I think, to the markets, and possibly you could shed some light on that.
Not very much light, but I'll say in the first question on oil shale, you're certainly correct that oil shale is another example of these unconventional hydrocarbons at a very, very large scale. The problem has been they've always been $20 a barrel more expensive than whatever the price of oil is at that time. Now, on the other hand, there have been some developments. Shell, in particular, has some new technology where they are suggesting that they are producing some shale. I think it's in Wyoming. I forget if it's Wyoming or Colorado. That they are currently producing shale oil by steam heating, basically, at a reasonable price. What I don't know, and I think it's undemonstrated, is whether that can scale up to anything large. There are environmental impacts, all kinds of issues to discuss. With regard to the market structures, first of all, oil price, I think, as we all know, oil price is basically a world price. So the only thing that determines the price, apart from some fairly minor transportation costs, is quality of the oil. The numbers we hear today are for very attractive oil, and it might be $10 or $20 less for other oil. But that's a world price, whereas gas prices, certainly in the United States, remain largely decoupled from world gas prices. So first of all, there's a decoupling of those prices. On the gas price coming down to between $6 and $7 now from its peak is the fact that, first of all, that peak was quite artificial given the hurricanes, but secondly, warm winters have a huge effect on gas prices in the United States. It's a lot of gas in storage right now, which has lowered that price. As to why the oil price is $75, that is a discussion that I think my colleague Steve Coonan could perhaps shed some light on.
My new idea, not Richard.
Right. I mean, it's clear that there's a lot of froth in that price,
John,
given political uncertainties.
I can't see, but I think that's John.
Yeah, I can't see either.
John Holdren, Harvard University and the Woods Hole Research Center. Ernie, I want to start by saying I thought that was a wonderfully comprehensive and astute tour of the horizon of what the energy issue is all about. I have two comments/questions. The first is, in the discussion of the MIT modeling results showing what kinds of trajectories would be associated with getting to stabilization at 550 parts per million and what the consequences of a 10-year delay would be, you were looking at 550 parts per million, but as you know, there is increasing evidence and concern that 550 is not a particularly prudent target, and that it might well be more prudent to try to stabilize at 400 to 450, corresponding at the mid-range sensitivity of the climate models to something like 2 degrees C increase over pre-industrial rather than 3. And the question is, have the MIT folks run some cases in that domain? I strongly suspect that if they have, one finds that 10-year delays are much more problematic when you're looking at a lower target. That's the first question. The second question has to do with trying to solve the climate problem and the oil problem simultaneously, and the question of whether the tar sands and the oil shales are indeed a practical way to do that. You mentioned very quickly in passing that there are environmental problems with tar sands and oil shales. A very large one of those environmental problems is that the CO2 per gallon of liquid fuel delivered is much, much higher.
Correct.
For both the tar sands and the oil shales with any technology I currently know about. And so that actually looks like an approach to alleviating oil addiction that makes the climate problem worse, unless one can figure out how to capture and sequester that carbon, as well as
right.
the carbon from coal-burning power plants, for example.
Yes, thanks, John. Those are two very good questions. The first part was a complaint that I was using this doubling, in some sense, as the benchmark. And John certainly is correct. The at 550 parts per million CO2, which is twice pre-industrial, one is getting into very uncomfortable regions. 3 degrees centigrade increase, plus or minus, likely significant impacts. So there's increasingly an aspiration to target something like 450 parts per million. We are today at around 380, I guess it is. Let me first note that on the slide that's currently up there, the green trajectory, again, is the what you saw before in the high tax scenario. If you look at the cumulative emissions of carbon dioxide in that green or high tax scenario out to 2050, that represents about 55% of the emissions budget for the 550, and represents about 110% of the budget for 450. So John has pointed out that this dog don't hunt if you really want to talk about holding to 450. Clearly, one can crank up in this model the carbon price until you force it to 450, but it's a scenario. It would be an extraordinarily challenging one to reach. Although I might say as an aside, John, I certainly will not discuss publicly, but we're fooling around with a $1,000 a ton carbon tax and various recycling schemes to accomplish more aggressive goals. So that just shows you, if you want to do this 450 more comfortable, still not completely comfortable, but more comfortable goal, really requires enormous policy changes. The second question was that of the tar sands and other unconventional oil. And John, of course, is completely correct. That is an example of a pathway that can address the security issue but is counterproductive on the climate side, barring other heroic acts like capturing and sequestering the carbon. But those approaches dramatically increase carbon emissions, as does other approaches I would have talked about given time. But, for example, another approach is to use coal, let's say, and to make liquid fuels or chemicals. This is being done, this is growing rapidly, by the way, in China. And typically, in rough numbers, you would have twice as much carbon emitted compared to the original petroleum-derived fuel. So these alternatives in contrast to biofuels, go in the wrong direction with regard to CO2 unless you capture. In the scenarios that I showed, with that enormous 100 million barrels a day of CO2 to sequester, that did not include any coal to liquids. That was just from essentially power plants. So this would add to that challenge unless you backed out the coal from power with much more robust nuclear and wind and PV growth.
Let's take one last question. That's all we have time for. Please, right here.
Thanks. I'm Kelsey Lynn from Stanford University, and I'm wondering, you showed us some example carbon taxes, and I'm wondering if we had signed the Kyoto Protocol and went about that through a carbon tax to raise money to capture carbon and sequester or use renewable energy or whatever, what kind of carbon tax would we be looking at now, like, approximately?
I'm sorry. So the question is, what tax would be equivalent to Kyoto
in
targets?
In order for us to be meeting that goal.
That would be a guess.
Really is,
yes. Well, yes and no. Okay, but that number I can certainly talk about. If you were to capture and sequester CO2 from today's coal plants as a retrofit, let's say, that would be around $60 to $70 per ton of CO2. However, if you, for example, for coal, if you build a new coal gasification plant and ask what would be the carbon price on a pulverized coal plant, that would bring you to the same cost as the gasification plant, that would be $25 to $30 per ton of CO2. So that's kind of a normalizer about what it costs to capture.
Would Kyoto have broken our back? I mean, to ask a different kind of question.
No, I think. Well, I have to say that, first of all, there's much to quibble with in terms of the structure of Kyoto, Kyoto 1, okay? But nevertheless, the kind of goal being talked about, obviously, I believe that we could address that goal with sensible, absolutely sensible economics. In fact, probably, if done right, net benefit in a variety of ways, driving new technology, et cetera. Certainly, one can argue whether or not Europe is going to meet its goals, but certainly to date, one hasn't noticed a tremendous crippling of the economy. But I think the real issue is going forward with this. First of all, you know, Kyoto's goals were certainly not robust enough to manage this problem. So the real issue is what comes after Kyoto, lots and lots of questions. And by the way, I'm happy to answer more questions after we break up as well.
Please do. As the senator says, Ernie Moniz knows stuff, and we want to thank him for sharing that stuff with us today. Thank you all.